And he had a sniffle coming on, and he felt it coming on, and he reached in his pocket, and he got his hanky out. And he unfolded that hanky, and it, of course, it draped down over his chest here, and he let out a big snort, you know. Well, the back row came alive. They thought it was the last trumpet, and the judgment call was next. And so I hope, you know, that I don't have to snort too much tonight, today. I have some things that I'd like to present to you. I believe that some of these things have been on my mind the last several days. They began possibly with a Phoenix reunion. Down there, we were reminded again in a priesthood meeting after the reunion, or at least midway through the reunion, we had this priesthood meeting, and we were calling Brother Hausnick into question about his vision that he had. And in this vision, he experienced the Church of Christ at the crossroads. And at this crossroads, he found people there that were wandering up and down the crossroads, and some there who were caught in between at the very corners of the crossroad, and they were looking which way they should go and what they should do. And emblazoned across his mind, and very possibly in his own mental picture of this vision, were four words, two of which I would like to speak on today: indecision and fear. And I've thought about that, and I thought, you know, as my mind's eye was examining the people of the Church of Christ and trying to understand just exactly, you know, are we a very indecisive and a very fearful people, you know? And I had a little bit of difficulty being able to pick out and to choose individuals who were very indecisive and who were very fearful in their walk of life. But I began examining this, and I began trying to understand just exactly what's encompassed by the word indecision. I looked this up. And indecision in Webster's dictionary is wavering between two possible courses of action. Being unable to decide which one of these courses of action that you're going to take. And of course, everyone knows or possibly has experienced sometime fear in their lives. And so we don't particularly need a definition of fear. And so I thought about this first one, indecision. And I thought of a scripture over in Joel. It's in the third chapter. And it speaks of multitudes in the valley of decision, that the Lord has gathered his people in this valley of decision. And I thought, you know, that here, you know, we are the Church of Christ at this crossroads. If this vision is true, that we are at this valley of decision, and that decision has vast repercussions as far as our spiritual concerns are concerned. Where we may go and what we are doing, how we are cultivating, what we are developing into. You know, and so we ourselves find ourselves in a position in decision making at the valley of decision. I had a couple of days ago, I was in my truck, and I came to a corner, and it was a little back street corner, and I was cutting around to get back on a main street, and there was a car out in the middle of this intersection, and the way the sun was reflecting off the car, I couldn't perceive that anybody was in the car, but it was just sitting there. It was just right here at this intersection. The car was just sitting still. And I was looking back and forth, looked off to the left there, and there was a man standing on the corner there. And he might as well have just been twiddling his thumbs, and he acted as if he didn't know what to do and what he was, you know, what was going to happen next. Possibly he was waiting for a bus or some other thing. And there was a couple of other people on the opposite corner, and they weren't moving. They were just standing there. So, let's see, come apart here. So I thought, well, boy, this is kind of strange. What's this car doing out here in the middle? And I looked over inside of that car, and I seen this woman who was laying down in the interior of this car, and she was crying and screaming inside this car. I said, what on earth? You know, I was thinking of the contradiction of seemingly life was going by, and there were people here on the intersections, and people who had the capability of moving and assisting and promoting, you know, the ministry of help in, as far as this woman's benefit is concerned. And here she was by herself, you know, and she was crying. She'd get up and moan and throw her hands in the air and then lay down in the seat again. And I jumped out of the truck, you know, and as I was running towards her, you know, this guy was standing on the corner. I said, what's the matter? You know, what's wrong with her? Well, I don't know, you know, I guess some guy just rear-ended her, you know, and he just left around the corner. And I ran over to the car, you know, and I tried to jerk the door open, and the door was jammed shut. She had been rear-ended, and there she was in there, and she was crying and moaning. And beside her, in the passenger side, was her mother. And her mother was reclining back in this seat, and her eyes were propped open. And as far as I was concerned and could understand, she was dead. And, you know, and I was looking at this woman, you know, and her eyes wide open. And it wasn't a petrified look, but she was just sitting there, you know. And I was thinking, you know, is this what it is, you know, when a person dies? And here, in contradistinction to that, was this woman who was just throwing herself around the car and screaming and yelling, you know. And she says, I'm going to have a baby, you know, I'm due for my baby now, you know, and I think my baby's hurt, I'm going to have this baby, you know. And she's moaning and groaning, and then she'd look over at her mother like this, and she says, oh, Mama, like that, you know. And then she'd get back to, oh, you know, my baby, and so forth. And here she was, wavering back and forth, indecisive. And I asked her, I said, well, hey, you know, I've got a truck right here. You want to jump out of your car? You want me to get in my truck, and I'll wheel you up to the hospital? And she said, oh, no, my baby, you know, I don't know what's happened to my baby. And there was her mother, you know. And I hope that you're understanding what I've seen in this. I've seen a woman who was beside her mother, who was stark petrified into emotion. That she was unmoving. She could not raise a muscle. She had not the strength to blink her eyes. She was petrified in fear and shock. And beside her was this woman who was in agony of indecision, of undecided, what she can do, and who's going to help me, and what should I do, and where should I go, and so on and so forth. Well, it was shortly after that that the emergency vehicles came up, and they rescued her, and a man came up to the passenger side of the door, and the window was down, you know, and he grabbed hold of this woman's jugular vein like that, and then finally just kind of tapped her on the cheek, and he says, come on, he says, now, he says, we've got a little difficulty right here. He says, wake up and involve yourself with us, you know, and quit, I don't exactly know what the word is. But anyway, immediately as he tapped her on the cheek like this, she revived, you know, kind of shook her head, you know, well, where am I? Where am I going? And so I seen this. I seen a total picture of indecisiveness and fear. And so I'd like to talk about that. I'd like to talk about what is the possibility of maybe indecision that has involved itself in us? And what promotes it? And what causes this? And what causes an individual to be indecisive as far as God is concerned? So there's a scripture in 1 Kings, the 18th chapter, 21st verse, and it's referring to Elijah. I'd like to turn to that. Any of you have any scriptures, you might turn to that yourself. And he comes before the priests of Baal, and there were 400 of them. And the priests of Baal worshiped the god of Baal, the god of the world, the god of lust and of carnality, of mammon, and of every respect that's apart from God. They worship him, you know. And so he comes up to him and he says, I challenge your men, you know, to prove your god. And we'll put your god to the test with my god, and we'll see who prevails. And so in this 17th verse of the 18th chapter of 1 Kings, so it came to pass when Ahab, who was the king at this particular time, he says, he saw Elijah, and Ahab said unto him, art thou he the trouble of Israel? And Elijah said, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and thou hast followed after Balaam. And so he challenges them this fire to this contest between the priests of Baal and of God. And he goes over here and he makes this statement, if I can find it real quick. And Elijah came unto all the people and he said, how long halt ye between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people answered him not a word. And so I find, you know, in this halting between two opinions, I find the answer to my quest of indecisiveness. And this may not be the whole picture, but I see in this something that may relate to every one of us. And that possibly is the decision and the difference of opinions relating to the pursuance of God and pursuance of the godly way and doing the things that God hath commanded his army here on earth to do, as opposed to the armies of Baal, to the armies of mammon and of the world, and the desires and the lusts thereof, and the pursuance of them. And so we find sometimes that people find themselves at the crossroads, and they're unable to decide because of a scripture that we're going to read later on because of the deceitfulness of riches. Now, if I would have you raise your hand right now, and everybody here raise your hand if you're materially rich, you know, there's probably very few people who's going to raise their hand, you know, and if there is, you know, raise your hand. I'd be glad to see it. Feel that you're materially rich. Well, I'd like to declare something to you that I feel that I, who works a little 8-to-5 job, you know, 5 days a week, I feel that I am materially rich. I talked with Alfredo some time back, and he goes down, and he was born and raised in Mexico. And he says, if you go down into Mexico with a little old 52 Chevrolet, beat up, got rust, and it's got a few dings here and there and so forth, he says, you go down into Mexico, and says, you'll be flooded with a multitude of people and exclaiming, you know, where did you get such a fine automobile? You must be rich. You know, where do you get your money? You know? And so I understand and I feel, you know, that despite the paycheck and despite what I do and I don't have, I feel that I'm rich. I feel that I'm materially rich and that I abound with all the accoutrements of good living. And that I live comfortably and I live in such a way as that I appear as a king before other peoples of this world. And so, in thinking about this being materially rich, you know, I think about, well, there's some people who are richer than I am. You know, some people who got bigger paychecks and they have jobs, you know, that reap for them a wealth more of material goods, you know. And well, are they rich? Well, certainly they're rich. But then I think, you know, that in our richness, and as opposed to the richness of this man who has a greater paycheck than I, he may have debt and he may claim that he's broke, and sometimes, you know, that I claim that I'm broke, but our level of indebtedness is just at a different level. That we're both claiming to be broke, but at the same time we have surrounded ourselves with the entrapments of wealth and of fullness of the material life. You know, and so how do we deal with that? And how does God speak to us? What is He saying when He talks about money, when He talks about wealth? Exactly what does He have in mind? I'd like to read you several more scriptures right here. In Matthew, the 13th chapter and the 22nd verse, we find an interesting account. And it's talking about money. And in this parable, it's talking about the parable of the seeds, and it says that a sower came and he sowed a number of seed on the ground, and it was good seed, and he sowed seed on rocky places. He said he sowed seed, you know, off to the wayside. He sowed a number of different areas, but in one area that he sowed his seed was among thorns. And said he also received seed among the thorns, and this individual that has thorns, and whom the seed is sown in, says, is he that heareth the word, and the care of this world, and the deceitfulness of riches, choke the word, and he becometh unfruitful. Well, you know that there's a key word right here in this 22nd verse that speaks to me. It's deceitfulness. Well, you know, there are some people, you know, who have an abundance of money, and they know how to handle it. And they know how to handle it in a godly way, you know. And we've seen that. We've seen the benefit of those who have an abundance of gifts that God has given them in the way of materialism. And they know how to handle that. But it says right here, it says that there is an inherent weakness with riches. And it says it's the deceitfulness of these riches. And that it has a way of coming up behind you and sneaking and deceiving you. Well, you know, we can all say, hey, well, don't deceive me, you know. I know how to handle my money, and I know how to do this and that and so forth. But I want you to bear in mind that Satan, you know, once was a fallen angel. Or he is a fallen angel. He once was an angel. And he has within him the powers of great intelligence and perception and understanding as to the workings of mankind. And he knows how to deceive. And he knows how to use something that is common with us as money to deceive us to do what? He's attempting to overthrow the kingdom of God and to dilute your testimony and to create an indecisive individual who is unable to decide if it be God, follow him, or if it be mammon, follow them. There's another scripture. It's about the rich. It's about Lazarus and the rich man. It's Luke in the 16th chapter. Let's turn to that. It says, there was a certain rich man which had a steward. There was a certain rich man which was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. And there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, this is in the 19th verse, which was laid at his gate full of sores. Now you'll catch in the 19th verse right here, he says that he was clothed in purple and fine linen and he fared sumptuously every day. And in contrast to that, at the very same time that this man was feasting and dwelling in houses in which were decked with purple and fine linens and you know, wall-to-wall carpeting and whatever we recognize as good living. At the same time was a certain beggar named Lazarus, which was laid at his gate full of sores. And desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table, moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. You know, I relate with dogs for some reason. I have told this before. I've always had dogs, and dogs epitomize to me, you know, virtues in which mankind seems to be lacking in. In 21st verse right here, it says that we find these dogs licking his sores, exercising more compassion and more concern and more mercy to this man possibly just outside of the doors of this rich man. It came to pass that the beggar died, and it was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom, and the rich man also died and was buried. And in hell he lifted up his eyes, the rich man, and in torments, and he seeth Abraham afar off, and Lazarus in Abraham's bosom. And the rich man, he cried, and he said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus, that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool the tip of my tongue for his thirst. I'm tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, Son, remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest thy good things, and likewise Lazarus, evil things. And now he is comforted, and thou art tormented. Well, down here further, you know, he said, well, you know, he says, I've got such great pain and torment right here. If I cannot be released, well, then send Lazarus to my brothers, my five brothers who are remaining yet alive. Send him to them and tell them, you know, of how much torment that I have here. And Abraham tells him, he says, They have Moses and the prophets. And Lazarus says, yeah, but just send him Lazarus coming from the dead. He says, they wouldn't even believe him. He says, you have the word. And we have that understanding now. And we have that awakening to arouse ourselves and to begin to examine and understand if the deceptiveness of riches has entered into our lives and has created a monster of indecision within us. You know, that's our question today. 12 and 21, Luke. And he spake a parable unto them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. I mean, he really produced. He really cashed in. He got a bonus for the year, you know. He got a dividend from his IRA. There's, you know, this rich man right here is his ground produced, and he's got it, you know. And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do, you know, because of all of this plentifulness, of all of these riches? He says, I have no room where to bestow my fruits. And he said, this will I do. I got an idea. I will pull down my barns, and I'll build greater barns. And there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, he says, now! He says, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said unto him, thou fool, you're going to build greater barns, and you're going to take your abundance, and you're going to put it in these barns. He says, you're a fool. You know, this man I see in here, and it's unwritten. But I see this over and over again as exemplified by mankind. This man, it says that he's got an abundance and he's going to tear down his barns and he's going to build bigger barns. I see a reoccurring cycle in this man's life. You know, possibly one time he owned a bicycle, you know, and he had a tent, you know. And somehow it entered his mind, he said, well, there's a possibility, you know, I can cash in this bicycle, you know, for four wheels, you know, and this tent for a shack. And so he's climbing. And he's increasing in the wealth and the goods. And I want you to understand, there's nothing inherently wrong with that in and of itself. But there's something that happens when the deceitfulness of riches begins to consume and erode away the riches of God. And so this man has done this, and he finds himself, you know, possibly saying and having said many times, you know, now, soul, he says, I'll take my rest. Now I can rest, and now I can sit back and enjoy the fruits of my labors. You know, and how often have we said that? And I felt my soul saying that to myself, you know. He says, now, he says, you know, if I only sock away, you know, just another $50 in the bank, you know, if I can only just buy this, you know, then I can sit back and relax and I've got it. Well, how many times, you know, that, you know, in the common household, the householder, they get to the point where we've finally arrived at wall-to-wall carpeting, you know. We got three TVs in the house and two cars in the garage, and we're saying, you know, man, you know, look what I've got. And somebody comes up who's got less of you and they're admiring what you have. And maybe possibly 3 or 4 years later, wall-to-wall carpeting gets ripped up. Tear it off and say, can't stand that dirty stuff. So let's lay down some more carpeting. Can't stand that car. You know, that's, you know, I've only got a Magnavox. I want a Zenith or something like this, you know. Whatever it is, you know, we're constantly pursuing an elusive goal of enough. So what is enough? When have you arrived? You know, when have you gotten to the point where you're allowed to live and to be comfortable, and the benefits and the joy and the fruits of your labors are sunk into something that is eternal and worthwhile and building for the advent of Christ Himself when He comes again, and he'll claim you and He'll claim your works. And what have those works been? 1 John, the second chapter, says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Now, you know, we're finding here keys. And I'm reading you certain scriptures that it should alert us. I mean, our antennas ought to just bounce out of our heads, you know. And we're alerted to the fact that God is saying something regarding the deceitfulness of riches. You know, it's an interesting fact. Of the 38 parables that Christ has written in the New Testament, 16 of those are involved with money. In the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, every 10th verse is involved with money and materialism and riches. And so we can understand that Christ is coming here and He's speaking through the pages of the New Testament, and He is warning that there is something that is elusive and deceptive and insidious about a little half a dollar or a $5 bill. You know, there is something destructive about that if it's allowed to accomplish that which Satan would allow to accomplish. But you know, like so many things in this world that we perceive and understand, money and some people say this regarding TV and newspapers and magazines and so forth, that they're a neutral force in themselves. You know, and it's how it's manipulated. And so money, that's a fact. The money can be manipulated to do great good and benefit to the kingdom of God here on earth. But it can be manipulated evilly. And so, as we find ourselves in this crossroads of indecision here, we need to decide, where are our riches and where are they going? It said, love is not of the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. Now, what I've done here, and I may have put you on the edge of the seat here, and I may have made you a little bit defensive, and I hope so, and I hope that you're weighing these things, and understanding that regardless of what your life scale is here on earth, and there may be some people who here in the audience, and I don't see any, who could be living in abject poverty, you know, and there may be others here who are just a common man, you know, and you're saying to yourselves, you know, hey, I'm not rich. You know, the deceptive of the riches hasn't claimed me. You know, I'm so tied down with debt, you know, I can't give an extra dime anywhere else. Or I can't, you know, I just don't have the resources to involve myself in such things. Well, I think again, you know, that we need to examine the deceptiveness of riches. Because I found multitudes of things in my home that I could have done without. And I could have taken the energy, and I could have taken the resources and the money that took to purchase that and to have accomplished something eternally for God. And so remember, you know, we're thinking of Lazarus right here. You know, we remember, you know, Lazarus is just an example. He's an example of a need. And there are great and magnificent needs in this world that can be served and satisfied by the richest people on earth right here. We've got people down there in Yucatan. I hear these testimonies from Uncle Skeet and Hubert and Donnie all the time. People down there who this is one example. Uncle Skeet says that they came down there and Cayetano, or one of those brothers there, had been working all day. And he works a horrible day. He works from sunup to sundown, and it was evening and it was dark. And they were in the house there and heard footsteps approaching the house. The man was just bone weary, been macheting hemp or something, working in the fields all day long. He comes in and he sees Uncle Skeet and Donnie, and he embraces them, you know, with his great love and concern. And his first desire is that they should be a beneficiary of the treasures that he has. And he immediately uses the resources within him, and he leaves, and he goes back out into the woods, and he kills him a little deer. I think it was just a little deer. And he was out there for several hours after working something like a 16 or 17 hour day. He comes back laden with this little deer, and then he asks them to sit themselves while he prepares this before them. And then he sits and watches them eat, you know. Who is rich? And who's using their talents and their abilities and their resources? There was a man, Cornelius, in the 10th chapter of Acts. And this man right here, he was a, you know, what I'm able to glean out of the scriptures, he was a rather wealthy man. And it says, there was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of the band called the Italian Band, a devout man and one that feared God. He was devout, he was dedicated, he was determined to pursue God. And he feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people. And he prayed to God always. And he has this vision, and in this vision there was a being that came to him, and it says, and when he looked on him, this being, he was afraid and said, "What is it, Lord?" The fourth verse. And he said unto him, "Thy prayers and thine alms are come up for a memorial before God." So your prayers, your desires, and your riches have come up before God because of the great benefit that you have desired of them. And so we find that as a result of that, you know, that the gospel is opened up into a great new outreach as a result of the prayers and the alms of Cornelius. And they stand as testimonies to us ringing down through the ages of time that this man had used his resources and his talents and his abilities for the promotion of the work of God. James, the first chapter and 27th verse. In this particular verse right here, it's talking about what it is to be religious, what it is to be righteous. And it says, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this. This is pure religion. I mean, you're going to take out all the drought and anything that might kind of confuse the issue, and we're going to find out exactly what pure religion is, unmixed and undefiled before God. And the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. Now we're pursuing right here. This is the instruction manual. You know, we find in this, you know, if you want happiness, if you want to promote, I hear prayers all the time, and we'll have brothers and sisters to be kneeling, and they'll be praying, you know, Lord, promote the work of the gospel. And sometimes in times past, and I thought this cynically, what work? You know, what work of the gospel? You know, promote and further the work of the gospel, you know. And so I see, and I'm able to understand through various testimonies of a few brothers, a few sisters here and there, and they're promoting the work of the gospel. Among rich people, they're promoting it. They're in the arena there, and they're the ones that are getting dirty, and they're scarred and fighting for their lives and pursuing a course of possibly certain death. And there on the sides of the arena and in the grandstands are those. Observers, they're spectators in the arena of the conflict of your life. Here, I've got another scripture over here in Daniel, and I'm going to have to stretch this to help you understand what I mean by it. Daniel was taken over by he was a Hebrew, and he was taken over by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had invaded the kingdom, and they took over the kingdom, and Daniel happened to be within the kingdom. And Daniel was a very young man at the time, and the king had asked some of his hierarchy to go examine among the children of the Hebrews to see if you can find among them certain young men who are unblemished and who are filled full of wisdom and understanding and bright prospects for the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar here. And so they went and they sent their emissaries out into the land, and they found several young men, among whom was Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And in this account right here, the king had admonished his officers. He said, now when you have these men, he says, I want you to feed them of the very best of the land. I want you to give them the king's wine and the king's table, that they may grow up and be developed in every respect, and that they would be able to serve me and to serve the kingdom to its greatest extent. And so Daniel didn't like this idea. He was very wise and very understanding from the very beginning. It says, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. It says, therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. So the prince of the eunuchs, you know, it put him in a very compromising position. You know, he was very distressed because the king had ordered him. He says, they will eat of the king's table and of the king's wine. And here Daniel said, well, we don't want to. He says, we want to eat beans. They call it right here, they call it pulse. He says, we want to eat beans, and we want to eat the hearty and the rugged and the nourishing food of our youth. And you, prince of the eunuchs, if you will allow us 10 days, you know, if you give us some time just to prove this fact, and then you can decide for yourselves whether or not, you know, we have improved before you. And so they did that, and it was discovered after 10 days that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their faces were fuller, and they were filled with the flush of life, you know, and vibrating within them was great presence of wisdom and understanding. And so the king understood this, and he seen that, you know, and he began examining these young men, and he found out that their wisdom and their understanding was 10 times greater than the rest of the oracles and the sorcerers and the mystics of their time, of their day. And so the point that I understand from it, of this, is that they had not, as David in Psalm says, partaken of the dainties of the rich man. David makes that statement in Psalms. He says, I will not partake of the dainties of the rich man. He said, because in them is deceitful meats. And so we, you know, very much are partaking. As we live here in the 20th century, we're partaking of the dainties of the king's meat. We're feasting upon deceitful meats and offerings. And we're drinking of the king's wine. And it is having its effect. It's causing something in which we are not able to arise in very much respect. We're not able to arise and to decisively move forward in the power of God and do the things that he desires of us to do. But we have desires within us which are great. And they foment and they roll and they roar like the sea. And they say, you know, that, yeah, but what about me? You know, I have desires. I want a good home. You know, I didn't have it. My parents couldn't provide that for me. But I'm going to provide it for my children. You know, we're going to have this. Whatever the excuse is and the delusion that comes into our minds, we are consumed by a desire to surround ourselves with the entrapments of this world at the behest of the spirit and the power of God that could create us within us as Daniel, the spirit of great understanding and wisdom. In Isaiah, the 51st verse, it talks about what I call peer pressure. We are surrounded, and you know, when we wake up in the morning, if we wake up to a clock radio, if we turn the TV on, if we read the newspaper, as we're driving our cars down the road, we are bombarded and we're surrounded and we're immersed and filled with what the world desires of you. And the world's speaking to you. And they say, you know, this is what it takes to become a man. You know, if you want all the gusto, you know, this is what you have to drink. If you want to become rich, you know, you have to smoke this brand of cigarette to have these riches and cars and glamorous women around you. You know, whatever the world says, they're telling our minds what it takes to be a success. You know, reminds me of a statement I heard a man say the other day. He says, like taking Mr. Milk Toast and putting him in a Jaguar XKE, you know, and suddenly becomes Macho Man, you know, and that's all he needs. Just a big car and a gal there beside him, you know, and he's got the solution to all the world's problems, you know, and the world is just passing by him. And so in this seventh verse of the 51st chapter, it says, hearken unto me, ye that know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. He says, now if you consider yourselves children of the kingdom, he says, hearken unto me. He says, fear ye not the reproach of men, neither be ye afraid of their revilings. You know, how many times have you heard that? You know, somebody said, oh, you're a goody two-shoes, you know. I had that said to me one time. It says, what do? You wear Pat Boone shoes to church? You know, I mean, you know, they think, you know, because you're standing your course and you try to remain resolutely in the face of retribution and the revilings of the world, you know, that they will come against you and they can revile you. And if you're weak and if you're affected by such things, then you fear them and you fear the revilings. You fear the opinions of the world. You know, what are they going to think? You know, what are they, you know, if I don't have Jordache jeans on, you know, they think I'm some kind of a dummy or something. You know, I'm poor. You know, I ain't nobody. You know, whatever it is. If I don't drive such and such a car, if I don't live in such a neighborhood, you know, what are they going to think? It says, for the moth shall eat them up like a garment. It says, all these rich people, they're going to die one of these days. They're going to fold up. And everybody has a common heritage of a grave. There ain't no way to get out of it. There's no way of getting out of this world alive. But you're going to find yourself that is a great equalizer. And in this great equalization right here, all men stand before the bar of God. It says, for the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool. But my righteousness, my eternity, the benefits and the rewards gained for making the right decisions and to decisively pursue the right course shall be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation. There's I was thinking, you know, and I want you to feed on something. I never want to just tear you down and to have you consider that there's nowhere to go and nowhere but up. But I was reflecting in my own mind of the many testimonies of people who have decisively made decisions for God and who have fearlessly confronted their foes and have stood their ground resolutely, undiminished by the revilings and by the persecutions and by the arrows that the world would dash towards them. I remember, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I remember several years ago that we had a Phoenix reunion, and a man by the name of Harvey Seibel, in this reunion, he was convinced prior to the reunion that he needed to go to the reunion. He needed the strength. He needed to be uplifted. He needed to go down there and to serve God in just that small way. And he was he brought this up before his boss, as he has told me. And he says, we've got an important reunion coming on. He says, now I need time off to go to this reunion. I need the strength. I need that experience. And so, do you mind if I take the time off? He says, no, you can't have time off. He says, forget it. He says, we're too busy at this time of year. He says, it's just impossible that we can relieve you of your duties, you know, to carry off on some far-off reunion somewhere amongst a bunch of, you know, do-gooders. And so Harvey told her, I think it was a woman, told her, he says, when it comes to a decision between God and between the world and between my job, God comes first. Decisiveness. Now, I'm not lifting him up. I'm not saying that maybe he's a real decisive person. You know, he's got weaknesses just like every one of us. But that, to me, is a testimony of a man who was able to confront something and which could have possibly materially destroyed him. And he chose the better valor for doing something that was good and that he knew was needed and was directed of God. God had shown him, he said, that he needed to go to that reunion. And when it comes between a decision between God and between mammon, between this world, I choose God. And so, you know, that ought to speak to every one of us. That ought to say something, you know. And so many times, you know, we can sit back and we look at all with these individuals who have been able to make such decisions, you know, and we applaud them and we think, oh, such a great testimony. But we're waiting for your testimony. You know, we're waiting to hear from you. You know, where you stand up and you stand your ground and you don't bend and you don't flail. You don't give in to the onrush of the desires of this world. But that you stand and that you're able to stiffen your back and you set your jaw and you to make your peace with God and to stand your ground against your enemy. I think of Brother Anderson several years ago. When my dad was sick in Oklahoma, my mom had found out about it, and she called Brother Anderson, you know, and unbeknownst to him, he didn't know a thing about it. Said, Brother Anderson, we need to go down and administer to Dad. How soon can you be ready? Give me 5 minutes. And ready. 90-some years old. What was he, Mom? 98? 94 years old, the man was ready in 5 minutes. All he had to do was grab his hat and his scriptures, and he was gone on a plane off to Oklahoma. He was ready in a moment. He had resources that was developed within him that were ready to be unleashed for the will of God. He was ready in an instant to do the things that God would have him to do. But the deceptiveness and the deceitfulness of riches sometimes erodes away that treasury of desire within us. And sometimes, you know, we're so consumed. So, well, Doris, I've got to sweep the rug yet tonight, and I've got to clean upstairs, and the yard needs to be raked, and doggone, you know, I'm going to have to go to a football game. You imagine Brother Anderson going to a football game, but You know, sometimes we make these excuses, you know, but, you know, I'd love to. I'd love to be involved with it. You know, but I really just can't right now. You know, maybe next time. There's a man I was talking to, Hubert. I think his name is Placido down in Yucatan. And it says that Placido has developed within him, and it wasn't instant. It didn't develop overnight. It wasn't just created in a twinkling of an eye, but he has within him cultivated an ability to move people by his presence. He doesn't necessarily have to really say a whole lot. He doesn't necessarily have to win them over with the sword of his mouth or the strength of his arms, but he has a presence within him cultivated by years of development, in which he is able to wade into an angry crowd and mob, and said that this man is able to move in their midst, and the men who are bent on his destruction change their minds, and they want to buy him a new sombrero, you know. A man who has a spirit of love cultivated within him that he is able to move into areas in which we would have great fear and trepidation to involve ourselves with, because he has developed and he has not had to deal with some of the indecisiveness that we have had in the past. Donnie McIndoe has gone down to Yucatan. He was telling me the last time we were down there of how many times when you're going into a minister going into that land cannot be a minister. You can't go down into that land and expect to preach behind a pulpit in front of a congregation. You go down as a lay person, and if you're going to minister anything, you minister from your bench. You preach your sermon from your bench there, because it's illegal for Americans, from outsiders, from foreigners coming down there and actually ministering the word in a position of authority behind a sacred desk. And so it's also illegal to take tracts and Bibles and things down across the border there. Well, they had a little station wagon just packed full of all sorts of literature, scriptures, and so forth. And they knew they were going in the will of God, and Peter was confronted with that one time. He was confronted with the aspect of whether to obey man or whether to obey God, and Peter made the statement. He says that man ought to obey God in respect to laws that would pervert the will of God. And so they were going down there in the strength and the knowledge of that. And they came to the border there, and boy, they were anxious and a little bit apprehensive about, they're going to see our Bibles here. We haven't even got them covered up. They're just laying all over the car right here. They see that, and they're going to send us back or have us burn them or throw us in jail, you know, whatever. And they got there, and the man says, get on across the border, back into Mexico. So they just eased into Mexico, and not a word was said. Of course, the car behind them was stopped and detained and ransacked and investigated for everything, any kind of contraband they may have. We've heard those kind of examples in this book, God's Smuggler. Same kind of thing. I remember Joe Yates. I'm giving you examples of men who have acted decisively, men who have acted fearlessly for a higher and a greater cause. In this example of Joe Yates, I remember telling this years ago, he was invited to a company dinner. And in this dinner, boy, I mean, the booze was just flowing. They, you know, lots of rowdy behavior and rowdy people and rowdy conversation. And he was asked, he said, well, come on, Joe. He said, have a drink right here. And he said, no, he says, I don't drink. The man said, what do you do to smell like a man? In this dinner, he was sitting there, and he was just trying to pleasantly enjoy his water and whatever they was feeding him. And they had these roving troubadours who were asking the various tables, you know. He says, well, what song would you like us to sing? You know, a lot of it was country and western, you know, and they'd sing an old bawdy country western song, everybody clapping, hee-hawing. It was just really terrific and having a big time. And it'd been going on for some time, and they came up to him and said, Joe, he says, what kind of song you want to hear? He says, I want to hear Amazing Grace. And he said, they sang Amazing Grace. I don't know how you react to that. I don't know how you feel about it. I don't know what that does to you, but it gives me goosebumps. It makes me feel, you know, that I want to be in line. I want to be on that side of the line. I want to commit myself in such a way. I want to grow and build and strengthen others and do the things that men who have written emblazoned in eternal rock forever, good deeds that have built and are building and strengthening the kingdom of God here on earth. And so, I have those desires. And so, again, you know, we find ourselves within that crossroads of indecision. And are we going to remain there? Or are we going to begin desiring to partake and to pursue the course of righteousness? And if we have, and I believe this to be a fact, I believe that there are those among us who have been blessed with the power to make money. Some of us just ain't got it, you know. But there are those of us in this congregation right here that I'm speaking to who have the power to generate vast sums of money as compared possibly to me or someone else, you know. And they've got it, and it comes, and it flows, and they're able to just purchase just about anything their hearts desire. Well, I believe that in many ways, is a talent given of God to them. But how are they going to use that talent? What are they going to do with it? Well, they're going to fill their houses and their cupboards and their garage, and they're going to buy boats and Cadillacs and all sorts of nonsense that will fade away and molder and rot and decay. Or are they going to use those resources for something that will never perish? They are at the crossroads, and they have that decision. And so, those of us who don't have any money, you know, what do we do with our time and our resources and our abilities? If we don't have money, we may not have a lot of money, although I want to declare to you that we're all rich, that we still can give much, much more than we think that we can give. But even those of us who don't have quite this amount of money, we have lives that we can give. We have, you know, Bob, and I've really been encouraged with Bob. He's trying to, and we've had a priesthood meeting, he's trying to pursue a variety of means by which this people can be strengthened. He's trying to reach out to every one of you and try to find your niche and to strengthen you where you are. And he's instituted a program of visitation and of cottage meetings, and he's wanting you to be involved in these cottage meetings. Not just because the ministry wants something to say to the people who are there, but he wants you to grow in the grace of God. And so he's asking you, he's not just asking just a few of us, but he's asking every one of us to open our doors for cottage meetings and for visitations and for the ministry of God, that we can be built up in the faith, you know. Now, we can still sit there and indecision, and we can say, you know, well, really, you know, the world speaks louder than God speaks at this moment. You know, we can do that, and we can take our chances. You know, I don't know how many of you are aware of it, but I see now that we're at the brink of destruction. This world could be blown into cinders in a split second. At any moment, any time. You know, the Bible speaks of in the last days that all nations should be gathered down into Israel to battle. All nations are there now, right now. They're there. And you could find that this world could be just one blasted piece of charred embers in just a moment of time. And we sit here on the crossroads of decision and say, well, I don't really call the world is just as stronger than the call of God right now. So, I'm thinking, you know, I've already gone over just now, looked at clock. I'm thinking of what we can do for God. I'm thinking that we can give our time, we can give our resources, we can give our lives, and we can and become the kind of people that God would have us be. I remember in our history books referring to the invasion of England by Nazi Germany, and during, you know, out of the ashes of their bombed out buildings and the destruction of London, Winston Churchill stood up with a few stalwart souls and he says, "This is England's finest hour." And we have that opportunity to arise in our life's most finest hour now. If we can learn to put away, as Daniel did, put away the king's meat, and to learn to live and to be happy and involved, possibly in a harder way of life. You know, does that seem impossible? I remember tell a story on my dad here. For some reason, and I've never understood this, but for some reason as I was growing up as a kid, you know, I just liked to get my sleeping bag, sleep outdoors, you know. I'd get the old sleeping bag outdoors, and boy, my dad would shake his head, you know, and say, "I can't understand you." He says, "You got a good bed upstairs there, and it's warm up in your room, and you can comfortably be laying there, and you can sleep a full 8 or 10 hours in your bed, and what do you want to do? You want to get in some old flea-bitten sleeping bag outdoors where it's cold out and sleep in a sleeping bag, you know? I just can't understand you." Well, the point that I'm not making any point about myself, but the point that it is sometimes that we can learn to take satisfaction and stepping away from the accoutrements of good living and of comfortableness and of what the world has laid on us and written in our minds. We'd step away from that and weigh ourselves and sometimes in the compassion and the misery of other people's troubles and other difficulties. And that we can become pursuers of that pure religion which is undefiled, and ministering to the widow in her need, and the orphans, and those who need great compassion and great understanding. And we have that opportunity to step away from the ease of life and to grab hold of the old rugged cross, you might say, and to lean on it and to gain the strength of our lives. I'd like to close in a scripture. It's in 2 Chronicles. In this account right here, Jehoshaphat was king of, I believe it was of Israel at the time, the Judah, and they were being invaded by a very great and ominous army. There was certain destruction. They didn't stand a chance. They had nowhere to go. They were surrounded, and they were coming over the horizon. They'd seen them. And so Jehoshaphat, implored God. What are we going to do? What's going to happen? And the word of the Lord came to Jehoshaphat, and he makes this statement. He says, "Thus saith the Lord unto you," he said, "be not afraid, nor dismayed, by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's." He says, "Ye shall not need to fight in this battle. Set yourselves, stand ye still, and see the salvation of the Lord your God with you." If you would, get your red book right here and turn to page 134. Am I a soldier of the cross, a follower of the Lamb? Shall I fear to own his cause? Am I going to be intimidated or blush to speak his name? Must I be born to paradise on flowery beds of ease, while others fight to win the prize?